I beg your forgiveness tonight for a simple, if not simplistic, approach to faith. I've no intention of trying to cover the whole range of the New Testament's teaching on faith, and I make no apology for that. It's a short word, but not a short topic. I want to wrestle mostly with the practical and leave some of the deeper things for another day. But I think we ought to begin our journey at a crucial point of departure, which is found in Ephesians. For it is by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. And we start there just to make it clear that faith is not good works with a different hat on. What we have, even in faith, we have been given. What we have received out of the grace of God. We cannot boast about it for the simple reason it is not all our own work. In fact, it's not any of our own work. One of our earlier hymns says, you know, we possess by faith what I could not earn. And that's where we want to start with in faith. So having established that, let's head off into the wilderness to retrace some of the steps of Psalm 91. Here's the rather forbidding desert of Judea in southern Israel, and this is where Jesus spent his 40 days in the wilderness. And the earliest reference to that is in Mark chapter 1. It comes surprisingly quickly when you read the Gospel of Mark, just 12 verses in. At once the Spirit sent him out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days being tempted by Satan. He was with the wild animals, and angels attended him. And that's all that Mark says. If you want the detail about the temptations, you need to go to Matthew or to Luke. But I think we can hear, even in that little section there, those Psalm 91 bells ringing, particularly in the wild animals. Remember, he treads on the serpent and the lion. And, of course, that the angels attended him. Just a short reminder there, a brief reference back to Psalm 91. And what this journey is about is Jesus's struggles, if you like, in the wilderness. And when we say the wilderness, what do we think of? What bells does it ring, or would it ring if I could find my pen? If I just said wilderness to you, and we were keeping it in a Christian context, because that's why we're here, so we're not thinking of Bear Grylls eating whatever it is he eats in the wilderness. Can you give me a wilderness thought?
Emptiness,
yes. The wilderness is empty, yep. Biblical reference, so what happens in the wilderness?
John the Baptist,
yes. John the Baptist, JTB. Short for John the Baptist was in the wilderness, yep. It's got a bigger backstory than that, though.
Locust and wild honey.
The locust and the wild honey, yeah. John struggled to find... is that a nourishing diet, Jen? Locusts and wild honey? Are all the food groups in there? I don't think there's anything green in there. But even further back than John the Baptist.
The children of Israel.
Yes, the children of Israel were in the wilderness. The children of Israel were in the wilderness. Quite early on in the whole story, isn't it? They come out of Egypt and they kind of end up in the wilderness. And how did that go for the children of Israel?
Not well.
I think that's good, John. That's a little bit of an understatement, even. Moses goes up to the top of Mount Sinai. And to get the Ten Commandments, to meet God, and the evidence of God's presence is all around. The mountain is smoking and shaking and burning and all sorts of stuff. And while he's up there, what happens at the bottom of the hill?
Chaos.
That's right. Chaos at the bottom of the hill. Absolute chaos. And Moses comes down, having met with God, presumably one of the high points of human God interaction history, and to find that they have set up a golden bull, which is I don't think they worship the actual bull. It was a platform for the god that they were worshipping to stand on. And it was exactly like the ones they'd worshipped at back in Egypt. And he piles into Aaron, who's supposed to be in charge while he's been away. And Aaron says, "Don't be angry, my lord. You know how prone these people are to evil." They said to me, make us gods who will go out before us. As for this fellow Moses who brought us out of Egypt, we don't even know what's happened to him. Right? And it is almost comic, isn't it? So I told them, whoever has any gold jewelry, take it off. Then they gave me the gold. I threw it into the fire. And in one of the greatest verses in the Bible, and out came this calf. Nothing to do with me. It was completely magic. Okay? So that would be, if we think back to the temptations of Jesus, which one would that be? The calf is an idol. Yeah? Idolatry is what was at stake there. So no sooner had Moses left them than the people were tempted and they fell to idolatry. And then there was the food issue. They spoke against God and against Moses and said, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? There is no bread. There is no water. And we detest this miserable food. What miserable food were they eating?
The quails
and the manna, miraculously provided by God. Yeah? And now they look back, actually, now, and how human is this? We've all experienced. Now they look back to Egypt as the good old days. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. I'm sure that's not true. Also the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic. Now that's a healthy diet, isn't it? But now we have lost our appetite. We never see anything but this manna. They complained about the hardships. We were talking about the emptiness of the desert. Yes, they hated it. They had been redeemed out of Egypt, and now they want to go back. It was better for us. No wonder Moses was at his wits. No wonder God was at his wits' end with these people. You know? Yeah, quite. He should have let them go. But Moses says, no, for your honor, Lord. You know, for your honor. Stick with this people. So we see an interesting contrast between Jesus in the wilderness and Israel in the wilderness. He fasted those 40 days and he was hungry. And the devil says, why don't you turn the stones into bread? You could do that. And he says, no. And the devil says, well, climb on top of the temple and throw yourself down. You know, you are the Messiah. You are the Son of God. You won't be harmed. The angels will hold you up. But Jesus trusts in God. He says, no, don't test the Lord your God. And he says, I'll give you everything in the whole world if you bow down. And Jesus refuses to worship idols. And what's going on here? What's going on? Well, we're seeing that Jesus is the true Israel. Israel, from the very beginning, struggled with faith. They saw, they experienced the works of God. You know, they crossed the Red Sea, for goodness sake. They were redeemed out of Egypt, but they couldn't translate that knowledge and that experience into faithful obedience. Maybe they had a theoretical belief in Yahweh. But belief without obedience is empty. See the book of James. Jesus comes to encapsulate the nation of Israel in one life. And in this brief 40 days to reenact a major segment of their history, but this time done right. This time exhibiting faithful obedience. Why does he do that? Well, because the people of God were ultimately and repeatedly faithless. They had an agreement with God that they did not keep. They had an agreement with God that they were faithless to. And we see this dramatically and tragically acted out in the prophetic book of Hosea, where a powerful connection is made between faith and marriage. It's a well-known passage, the very beginning. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Jehoash, king of Israel. The kingdoms were in two now. They'd split up after Solomon. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, what a thing to say to your prophet. Go marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her. Why? For like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to God. It's a tragic, tragic situation. When you marry somebody, and there's a good illustration, isn't it? When you marry somebody, you commit to one person. You belong to one person. You've made a covenant with one person. And breaking that covenant in adultery is to smash it, to despise it, and the one that you have abandoned. And I'm not discussing here the vexed questions of, you know, divorce and the ramifications for Christians and things like that. What I'm talking about is the basic act of unfaithfulness, and particularly unfaithfulness in a covenant relationship. And the importance of a covenant, a binding commitment on two parts, explains something that is otherwise very hard to explain. Why are the Jewish people so insistent on one God and sexual commitment to one partner in marriage? Why those two particular things, and why are they so obsessed by them? All around them were cultures and nations who had no qualms. What difference does it make if you had one God or two or three? Really? I mean, as long as your worship is good and you give them all or whatever the sacrifice is, why does it matter? And in terms of sexual partners, what does it matter if you have, you know, two or three, as long as you love the one you're with? Or is that a hippie kind of thing creeping in? Or as long as nobody gets hurt, which would be the modern mantra. What is the problem? The reason, the problem is one and the same in both cases. The Israelites understood both marriage and faith as being covenants. And they understood the binding nature of covenant. Faith and marriage are binding for better or for worse. And we haven't got, who was most recently married in Mac here? Not anybody recently, but I think Ben and Jackie, we still do that, don't we, John? For better or for worse, for richer or for poorer, in sickness and in health. Why do we say that at weddings? Why not, you know, more realistically, as long as things are okay? Yeah. As long as richer, you're fine. Not so keen on poorer. Poverty is out of the question. Yeah. Or in good health or in not too bad health. I don't want to marry you. I don't want to be with you if you've got some chronic illness that I have to care for you for years and years. That is what people really mean nowadays, is it not? When they take these words, many, many people, hopefully not many Christians, but many people say those words for better or for worse. But what they mean is, as long as it's kind of convenient, that's what they really mean. The notion of covenant faithfulness has disappeared from our society. We have convenience dressed up in the language of romance. And that itself is not a modern idea. Israel had already acted out this part in its relationship, the people of Israel in their relationship for God. They were not interested in for better or for worse. They were only interested in for better. And God is faithful, but his people were not faithful. They cannot keep the covenant. And at key points, the identity of the nation is kind of collapsed into one person. When Israel was a child, you know, when the nation was young, I loved him. God looks back at that command at the time. And I called my son out of Egypt. But the more they were called, the more they went away from me. And what is their sin? They sacrificed to the Baals and they burned incense to images. Their sin is idolatry. Just one question. If you were Paul and you were in the synagogue and you had that text, is Jesus in there anywhere? God called Jesus out of Egypt. We tend not to get that. The Egyptian Christians love this. They've got all the stories of what happened in Egypt to Jesus and Mary and Joseph, because they fled to Egypt. So you know, Christ in all the scriptures. But this son, Jesus, is faithful. Jesus the Messiah keeps the covenant. You'll notice in Mark that just before he goes into the wilderness, he is baptized. Just as Israel passed through the Red Sea and then through the River Jordan, and God has called his people, my son, as he does here, but at the baptism of Jesus, he declares, you are my son. And crucially, with whom I am well pleased. Because Jesus was a faithful son, whereas Israel was not a faithful son. We have a faithful father and a faithful son who keeps the covenant. And so we can put our faith in a faithful God, and we can put our faith in his faithful son. We can rely on them. Because faith at its roots has the idea of trust and reliability or dependability. Our God is a faithful God, and Jesus is his faithful son. So that makes life easy, doesn't it? We have a faithful God, we rely on him. Life is a piece of cake from now on in. Well, maybe not. Because the better or worse question, the richer or poorer question, the sickness and health question still looms large in the lives of Christians. And I was really pleased that this morning Nick mentioned the scene in the boat. I don't know if you remember that in Mark chapter 8, I think it is. The scene in the boat. The disciples are all in the boat crossing the sea. And as the Sea of Galilee, a small sea, but one which is prone apparently to big storms. As they sailed, Jesus fell asleep. A squall came down the lake so that the boat was being swamped and they were in great danger. Two questions for you now. One, were they in danger? This is the easy question. Were they in danger? It says they were in danger. So let's not criticize the disciples for going off when it was just like Roth Park Lake, but stormy. No. They were. Have you ever been in a second question? Have you ever been in a boat, little boat on a heavy sea? It's a very scary business, I can tell you. And drowning is a very unpleasant prospect. Okay. And these guys I'm sure as fishermen from that area, they knew that people drowned in there all the time. So it's dangerous. And now comes a test of faith. And the disciples went and woke him up, saying, Master, Master, we are going to drown. We're going to drown. You cannot save us. We're going to drown. And he got up and rebuked the wind and the raging waters. This was Nick's point about the word. You know, one word from Jesus. The storm subsided and all was calm. Where is your faith? He asked his disciples. In fear and amazement, they asked one another, who is this? He commands even the winds and the water, and they obey him. Interesting little picture of faith. They were in great danger, and their faith failed them. When everything was fine, when the sea is calm, their faith was fine. They had plenty of faith when the sea is calm. We're all fine when the sea is calm. Our faith is fine. But when the sea gets rough and the danger is great, well, their faith proved a little thin. And who can blame them? It's a dangerous situation. But I think it would be nice to ask, you know, how is our boat at the moment? How's your little boat on Roth Park Lake with a couple of oars, right? You're going through life, you're crossing Roth Park Lake, and it's a sunny day maybe in your life, I don't know. Is that the case? You know, is life good? Finances good, health good, job good, work good, relationships good, future looking good. Well, in that case, faith shouldn't be a problem, should it? Everything's fine. But actually, in those circumstances, it's better to say our faith is untested. We're not sure, really, how strong it is, because we really don't know how it's going to hold up under pressure. But sooner or later, in all lives, I'm sure, the boat begins to pitch and dive. The wind begins to pick up. The tops come splashing over the side. You know, I don't know, maybe age takes its toll. Certainly taking its toll on me, I can tell you. Let's just dwell on that for one moment. Every silver lining has a cloud, does it not? In my experience, right? Think about our, just in terms of our age, I read today, the average age of Chinese people in 1960 was about 40, in the 40s, right? I mean, if you go back far enough, average ages tumbled, didn't they? In my lifetime, When I was a kid, we all lived to 65, or 67, I think men got to when I was a kid. Now, if we get to 60, we will get to, on average, men will get to 88. The good news is that men are catching up with women, apparently. They're not living longer than we are. Right? And well, that's a massive extension to life in my lifetime. So what's the problem with that? Well, you could list them, couldn't you? Dementia, Alzheimer's, the weakness of aging. That's the price of the deal. That's the cloud behind the silver lining. And then there's the hidden, I think, spiritual price of living in a society with such longevity. We no longer need to worry, do we? Heaven can wait. I'm not going to die tomorrow. I don't think so. I mean, I may. And you can come and say, well, there you are, Alistair, if I do. but you know, we don't think about dying tomorrow or next month or next year. Our lives have become, if not infinite, the boundaries are so far away that we don't need to worry about them. And faith recedes so often into the background when that is true. For as the years pass by, the boat has maybe been lying so peacefully. Suddenly, whatever happens, and it doesn't have to be age, does it? Could be ill health, could be redundancy, could be our children, could be anything comes. And suddenly there's water in the bottom of the boat. And we cry out to God, as the disciples cry out to Jesus. He might say, where's your faith, Alistair? And it's in the and if all those years of calm that we've enjoyed, maybe you haven't enjoyed any years of calm, forgive me if you haven't, but I think many of us have. And if all those years of calm have been, our faith has been inactive, it's been unproductive, if it's merely been on the surface without real fruitfulness, then in the warning of James, maybe our faith is dead or dying. If I can embarrass my wife, Mrs. McGee versus the apple tree in our garden, turned out one whole bit of our big apple tree was empty. Nothing in it. It had rotted away inside. It looked significant from the outside, but inside there was nothing of substance whatsoever. And that must be a terror, surely, that stands against all of our Christian lives. It can be summed up, I think, in the words of Jesus in Luke 6. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not do what I say? You know, we paint it, but what's the big thing written up in there next door, above the pulpit? Jesus Christ is Lord. We say that, we acknowledge it, everyone in this room, I'm sure. But it's one thing to say it. It's another thing to live it out as followers of Jesus. And he goes on to illustrate the point. Very, very well-known illustration. As for everyone who comes to me and hears my words and puts them into practice, I'll show you what they are like. They're like a man building a house who dug down deep and laid the foundation on rock. I wish they'd done that with my house in Whitchurch, is all I can say. When a flood came, the torrent struck that house, but could not shake it because it was well built. But the one who hears my words and does not put them into practice is like a man who built a house on the ground without a foundation. The moment the torrent struck that house, it collapsed and its destruction was complete. And that simple story sums up the connection between faith and works and steadfastness. Faith, says Karl Barth, is humble obedience. And in obedience, we need to dig deep against that rainy day, not waiting for the very moment where that massive wave is about to loom over our little boat. No, the digging is before that. The laying of the foundation of obedience is every day that the sea of life is calm enough to allow you to do that, and me to do that. Every calm day of our life gives us the space and the time and the energy and the resources to be digging those foundations. One question. If you look at the two houses, just the two houses, can you tell the difference? No. They look the same from the outside. They look identical. until the storm comes. It is the storm that reveals which one is firmly planted with a foundation of faith. Our lives can easily take the appearance of faith. The words of faith trip off our tongue so easily. But somehow, putting it into action is hard. It's been wisely observed. It is so hard to believe because it is so hard to obey. I guess every one of us here knows what it is to take Jesus on our lips and within a moment or within an hour or within a day struggle to live in obedience. And I guess too that all of us therefore know Kierkegaard's observation about how hard it is to obey. But I think there is some encouragement with those poor old disciples. Let's get back in the boat with them. The storm has been calm, and the boat eventually reaches the shore, and Jesus gets out. And what does he do? Sack them all? That's what I would have done. I'd have said, "You disciples are useless. I want to get some new disciples." He didn't do that, did he? He doesn't do that. And equally, they could have dwelt on their terrible experience of faithlessness, couldn't they? And said, "I just can't do this, Lord. I'm not good enough for you." Of course they're not good enough for it. But they didn't do that either. You know, Nick reminded us this morning that the outcome of that whole experience was them asking the right question. Who is this? Who is this Jesus? And as we started at the beginning, he is the faithful one. He is the faithful Son of God. And so, lesson learned, I suppose, when we get off the boat, we need to pick up the shovel. If it's a nice calm day in our life, and we start digging some foundations. We start being obedient to the call of the Lord, obedient to his instructions, listening to his voice, reading his word, letting the Spirit work within us. We are no different to those who followed Jesus. Imagine, I mean, at least we can say we didn't live with him every day of our life, you know, for 3 years, morning, noon, and night. That's our defense for our struggles. But let's not waste time on our failings, because we could easily do that. Navel gazing is so unproductive. Rather, let our faith be expressed in obedience. If God and his Son, who are faithful, have called us to dig, not for victory, but in victory, we should set out with our faith, pursuing obedience in our lives. Amen.